Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Here for the Deeper Waters podcast, giving you 2 hours of apologetics information, hopefully that you'll find that you can put to great use in your own works in evangelism and understanding your faith. Our guest today had been scheduled to be Dr. Gagnon, but he regrets to inform me that something's come up that he can't give 2 hours today and asked me to reschedule for later. So we have started working on a date. I tentatively have October 5th as a date to have him back, but nothing's written in stone yet. Just know that he does want to come on, he just has to reschedule it for later. And if you're wondering why I'm not getting it on sooner, well, that's because I'm scheduling more and more guests constantly. And in fact, if anyone has any ideas of anyone they'd like to see as a guest on here sometime that I might not have considered, please let me know about it. And I'll see what I can do. Okay? Well, our talk was to be about homosexuality in the Bible. And unfortunately, Dr. Gagnon, as I said, couldn't make it, but I'm going to do the best I can on that topic as well. I mean, it's not something I'm totally unfamiliar with after all. And, well, granted, I'm not going to do it at the level of Dr. Gagnon. I hope I'm going to give you something you can think about. Let's give some preliminary warnings here as well. First off, when we're out in the public square, I don't think our argument should be, the Bible says this, therefore this is the way it should be. I think if we're arguing moral principles, we can go outside the Bible and find that those are principles already established by God that we can find out by reason. Of course, I'm not for it against empirical evidence in helping us find this, but we largely use reason. And with this regard, I don't think we should back off from, say, scientific study on homosexuality or sociological studies. Because if what we're saying is true, true study done rightly, we'll bring that out. We just have to wait and see, and if it was a problem for study, we have to look and see whether there be more information or was it done wrong. We have to be willing to ask those questions, and I'm going to leave much of that to the scientists and sociologists out there. I'm just going to be seeing make a few general observations, but if we make the kid come out there and say we're opposing homosexuality because the Bible opposes it, well, we get into a whole lot of trouble. One of the first things would be, we would be accused of having a theocracy. And we're going to say, the rule of the Bible is going to be the rule of the land. And believe it or not, we don't really want that. We live, at least in America, in a country that honors freedom, including the freedom to worship as one sees fit. We don't want to be like, say, a Muslim nation, where if you go against the Muslim law, then you face penalties, including, in that case, the possibility of death. We want that if people want to be Christians, they want to be Christians not because they feel the pressure of a government forcing down on them, but because they become convinced that Jesus is who he said he was. No, I thought this episode, I apologize for my allergies are getting out of hand. You can sometimes hear that, unfortunately. Yeah, we live in the country, and just have it on mode here recently. That always does a number on me. But I still push through. And before I forget, I'm going to sign also about speaking. If anybody is here in the Knoxville area where I live, I will be speaking tomorrow during the Sunday service at the Farragut Church of Christ. We are doing it for disability awareness. And so, I'll be the speaker talking, giving an apologetic sermon. The guy who's invited me said, I want you to give your best apologetic sermon that you can, which is a great invitation for me. Although he did say something else about 30 minutes, I've been asking people, racking my brain, trying to figure out, what did he mean when he said 30 minutes? It's a concept that doesn't make sense to me. I hope I can figure it out before the service starts tomorrow. But anyway, we're going to this topic. The first problem is we will be accused of forming a theocracy. Now, there is going to come a day when God's rule on earth is supreme. Yes. But that's not going to come about by force. That's going to come out, I think, by evangelism. With people naturally choosing something instead of thinking they have to choose it based on force. The second big problem we have is that in our society, we live in a world where science has become the new priesthood. See, when we moved away from having a church hierarchy in some ways, now I think the Reformation was needed, yes, but there were a lot of negatives that came along with that as well. I'm still a convinced Protestant, but at the same time, I do realize that when we pulled away from authority, we had a tendency to pull away from our authority, which was an extreme reaction. And where if you move away from our authority, you have to have something else put in its place. For us, that's something else that has been eventually put in its place is science. Science is the new priesthood. It's got its prophets out there, such as the new atheist and others. And if you disagree with science, well, you're going against the accepted faith of the world. Now, I'm not saying any of this to insult science. No Christian should want to insert science. True science done right will lead to truth, just like in any other field. But I am against science being the ultimate authority. Science itself couldn't even establish that. And we have to make that distinction. If you're going to study the material world, there is no better tool to use than science. It's the best. But if you're studying ethics, philosophy, theology, logic, mathematics, history, etc., science isn't the best anymore. You have to use other methods. But at the same time, when we're entering into this area, we don't want it to be the Bible versus science. As soon as we do that, guess which side is automatically going to lose? And besides, do we really want the Bible versus science anyway? Don't we think the two should ultimately be in agreement? That the Bible and science will work together? Or not? The third great consequence is we keep up this stereotype that we don't know how to think outside the Bible. And that's something we have to counter. If we're going to study any field, we need to have more than just what the Bible says about it. If you're studying New Testament history, like I do, you need to know about Plutarch. You need to know about Tacitus. You need to know about Josephus. You need to know about so many other people outside of the world of the New Testament. If you're studying science, you need to know more than just, say, the book of Genesis. You need to know about the great minds of scientific history, and especially those in the field that you're studying. If you're studying philosophy, you need to know more than just the Christian philosophers. You need to know the atheist philosophers, pagan philosophers, etc. Christians need to seek to be as educated as they can in whatever field But, you know, and the more we prolong a stereotype that says we do not believe in being educated, we do not believe in learning, we're just going to go by what the Bible alone says. So I think the Bible itself we condemn, since it values seeking learning from others. We're only going to make the case worse, and we're going to make it less that people are willing to listen to us. Now, let's also talk about some pastoral ramifications of what we're talking about. I remember a few years ago being in a church service and hearing someone talk about how you should come to Jesus and offer whatever you're struggling, and even use an example of, if you're struggling with homosexuality, don't worry, just come to Jesus. He'll take care of that. I was just so stunned when I heard that. Now, I want to allay some of the fears of some of you. I am not denying that Jesus can do that. There are testimonies of people who have come to Jesus and they've been alleviated of any desires that are sinful. That happens. But it's the rarity. And there is no promise of that anywhere in Scripture. And we dare not promise anything scripturally that God Himself has not promised. We're instead told that we're going to have to struggle against temptation for the rest of our lives. Why think then that some temptation would suddenly disappear just because you became a Christian? I can guarantee you there are several men out there who, just because they become Christians, don't cease to have desires for other women other than their wives. Or single men who, just because they become Christians, don't suddenly have desires to have sex outside of marriage. If we come in and we just tell people that Jesus would do something for them, and He doesn't do it for them, the end result for them would be, Jesus lied, instead of realizing the person who made such a claim just didn't know what they were talking about. Instead, the church needs to have a kind, helping way of helping people deal with this kind of temptation. Because every person has some sort of temptation that's sinful that they're struggling with. And the church should be the place where you can openly find help to deal with what you're struggling with, where you can say what you're struggling with, and if you're repentant of it, if you're confessing it, you're saying you know it's wrong, the church will help you deal with it. And that means also the church does call sin, sin. If we're afraid to call something sinful because we might hurt someone's feelings, for instance, we're actually hurting them more in the long run. Because if there's something that sin does to a person, is it keeps them from being what Christ wanted them to be. Every single sin that you and I commit, it keeps us from living the Christian life that we were meant to live. How is it loving your neighbor if you are not helping them to be in the image of Christ? How? Answer, it's not. Now, this doesn't mean you go up to them and start talking about how they're going to burn in hell for all eternity and such. It means you handle it the right way. If they are seeking repentance, if they are open that they could be doing something wrong, you might just need to look at me and say, well, yes, that is sin, and you need to get past it. But if you're just going to go up there and give them threats with a system they don't really believe to begin with, probably won't do as much good. Now, when it comes to helping people in this kind of struggle, my main advice is that men should help men and women should help women. Men especially need to come alongside men who are struggling here and treat them like one of the guys, essentially. As I suspect a lot of them aren't very used to male companionship, and if they are, they are probably used to men distrusting them because they could be saying, I wonder if this person's checking me out, or something along those lines. Don't be afraid to be friends with someone who's a homosexual. In fact, when I worked at a job here several years ago, and I was getting ready to go on my lunch break, there was an older man I worked with who, and when he was a homosexual, and I was going to go out to a restaurant, he said, hey, how about I come with you? Sure, no problem. So he came with me, and we had a lunch together, just good, friendly chit-chat. You know, the number of times we ever discussed issues of his sexuality, never. It never came up. Now, if he'd asked me about it, I would have told him, well, yeah, here's what I really think, and here's why I think it. But it never came up. My goal was just to say, hey, I'm someone, I want to present myself to you as someone who you can come to. And when the time's right, you come. Now, does that mean I necessarily did everything right with that? No. Maybe there are times you should push ahead. But I think that most homosexuals already know the way the Christian community views them. What they're not used to is good treatment, in many cases, from the Christian community. Now, on the other hand, women need to help women. Men, I'm not sure how many of you listening out here might not have come across this conclusion yet, but we really have a very hard time understanding women. I paused a few seconds there because I figured some of you need to laugh a bit. Yeah, women are very much an enigma to us. My wife starts crying about some problem. My first intention is, hey, I want to go out there. I want to fix this. But that's not what she wants. She wants me to just listen to it. And that makes no sense to me. I'm looking at her saying, why aren't we doing something about the problem? To me, it's like having a disease and saying, I don't want the doctor to treat it. I just want the doctor to listen to me talk about it. And like I said, it doesn't make sense to me, but that's the way many women are. And the women out there that are struggling with homosexual desires need women who will treat them as if they were one of the girls. They need to have someone that they can fit in with. And also, we need to watch our language when we're talking about the homosexual community. We can use so many derogatory slang names. Yes, I know that these are names that they can use of themselves sometimes, but we're not going to add to it. I call a homosexual a homosexual. That's it. I don't use the term queer. I don't use any other term. I don't even use the term gay. Why? Because to me, gay means something specific. When we sing Deck the Halls, when we say Don't We Know Our Gay Apparel, or when you watch the Flintstones reruns and it talks about having a gay old time, it means something specific. And I'm not going to let that word be redefined just so some people can feel better. I use the word homosexual. It has a clear meaning. Everyone knows what it means. It's not derogatory. It is simply a statement of a fact. So I hope before we even get into the biblical text that we have some realization of where it is we're dealing with, that we know that how we approach the subject matter matters entirely, but that we also keep in mind that this is not just an isolated academic exercise. There are people out there who are struggling with this. There are Christians who love Jesus sincerely and have a struggle. And I don't doubt there are some homosexual persons who love Jesus but don't really know how to escape this lifestyle and maybe in some ways aren't even sure if they want to escape. If they don't, we have to be able to help them. 1 Corinthians 6 should be a scary reminder. If you practice this kind of lifestyle, it says, don't be deceived. They don't inherit the kingdom of God. In fact, I think he says, don't be deceived, because Paul knows this is something we are very prone to be deceived about. So I really hope that this preliminary part has really helped you think about the issue in consideration, because when I start talking about the text and such, it could look like this is just an academic exercise. It's not. And I won't deny that sometimes for me it could just become an academic exercise, but I hope by and large to overcome that. Well, we're going to go ahead now and take our first break. And if you want to call in and talk with me about this, my number is 714-242-5180. I'm Nick Peters, and I will be back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
And we are back. Our topic today is homosexuality in the Bible. Our call number is 714-242-5180. Now, some of you might be wondering, well, Nick, you just said the Bible shouldn't be used in a place of public debates. Right. And yet you're going to be telling us today about what the Bible says about the issue? Right. Why is that? Why? Because a lot of people in the church were also very confused about what the Bible says about this issue, and because there are so many times that you encounter the slogans of people out there on the left who will make a comment about, say, eating shellfish or having a tattoo and think they've come up with a killer argument against your position. Honestly, I look at those arguments and I think, no, you don't even begin to understand my position in that case. This is part of the shallow culture that we live in, that people go with this soundbite thinking instead of really looking at the argument in question. Just like there was this flowchart a while back about, so you think homosexuality is sinful, and has this layout of how to get out of this problem. When I look at something like this and think, this is someone who doesn't even understand my side. And most of this is largely emotional appeals. Now, there's nothing wrong in many cases with an appeal to emotion, but an appeal to emotion must be based on facts. A good case convincing an audience should be emotionally persuasive, but it should not be at the expense of rational content. What I want to be is that when you're in church, and you're discussing the Bible, or when you're discussing with homosexuals who want to use the Bible and say, well, this is what the Bible really says, or rather, doesn't say, and I want you to be able to stand up and say, no, you're interpreting the text wrong. Now, some of your people might say, well, it's all just a matter of interpretation anyway. What I'd ask them each time is, does the text really have any meaning? And that's the foundational question. If they say that something like, a text doesn't really have any meaning, it's just whatever you think it means, then I always ask them, how long have you been in favor of drowning puppies for fun? Some of you could be wondering, where did you get the idea that they do that? Well, see, if someone tells me that texts don't really have any meaning, I interpret that as meaning that that person has tendencies to animal cruelty. Now, you can't say my interpretation is wrong because a text, including a spoken text, has no meaning, doesn't it? Or could it be that, yes, what the text says, and in fact what you say, really does have meaning? Now, does that mean that the meaning is always crystal clear? No, not at all. I grant that. In fact, most of our problems with biblical studies today is we think the Bible is supposed to be crystal clear. It's not. Does this mean we might actually have to work to understand what the Bible says? Yep. You mean God's not going to just beam it down to our heads while we're praying intently? Nope. You actually have to work. Prayer is not meant to replace work. Now, the first place I'd like to go in our study today is going to be to the book of Leviticus. Leviticus, if you don't know it, is what's known as something pertaining to the Levites. And this is all about how the people are supposed to be holy before God. The Levites were the ones who guided the people in worship and religious ceremonies and in handing sacrifices and things of that sort. Now, the passage under question is in what's known as the Holiness Code. And the famous verse, the first one, is Leviticus 18:22. Do not lie with a man as one lies with a woman. That is detestable. Okay, so here comes then the objection back saying, yes, the text says it's detestable. It also says eating shellfish is detestable. Well, there are a few problems with that. Now, when we look at the word for detestable, which refers to an abomination, it is true that it can have a meaning sometimes of ritually unclean. But it can also have the meaning of moral wickedness. Which one is it? Well, the word that's used in this case only shows up in Leviticus when it does. It only shows up in chapters 18 and chapters 22. In chapters 20, I mean. And it's talking about these sexual sins largely. The word used in the passage about shellfish, that's a different word. Now, does it mean that eating shellfish is detestable for a Jew? Yeah. Because it would be seen as something unclean. And there are many reasons why this is thought to be so. One of my favorites comes from an anthropologist, Mary Douglas, I think was her name. And she says that for the Jewish population, the world was divided into three spheres of life. There were creatures that lived on the land. There were creatures that lived in the sea. And there were creatures that lived in the air. And in order for something to be pure, it had to belong entirely to one of those spheres. Now you say, well, shellfish do live in water. Well, yes, they do. But they also have a lot of characteristics of land creatures as well. And so in that case, they would be a mixture of land and water. Even by just appearance, something seemed to be a mixture, it would be declared unclean. This isn't to say that there was something evil about the creature itself. This was just to remind the Israelites of purity in everything, including their very diets. Now, some of us might think, well, purity, they were making too big a deal about purity. You know, as we, if you really think that, quite odd, because as I sit here, I just looked over, and I've got a bottle of hand sanitizer right here. See, I'm somewhat obsessive compulsive. I like having things nearby to clean my hands. And it's called Purell. Many of us happen to believe that if someone came in and put through dirt on our carpet, we'd have a problem with that. We like things to be clean. We clean our cars. I've got right here with me, in fact, a Brita water bottle that's supposed to purify any water that I drink. We want our water to be pure. We are people who value purity. We just value it in a different way more often. We don't think about ritual purity. We think about physical purity. Most often, we probably take showers and bathe far more than the ancient Israelites did. Not because they didn't care about physical cleanliness at all. They often just didn't have the means to do things as much as we do. But we are people who value purity, and we have to understand that the ancient Israelites value purity. And that was part of the basis of the law. When we look at things like tattoos, it helps to know that the surrounding pagan nations made a pretty big deal about tattoos. And so Israel, in order to show its separation from the neighbors, was not supposed to do that today. Does that mean you can't have a tattoo today? No. But that also doesn't mean you should. I mean, it's just like the dietary restrictions. Some nutritionists will look and say, well, you shouldn't eat these kinds of things anyway because they're unhealthy. That could be the case. I'm not here to comment on that. But what I am here to say is that we just have different reasons for doing things differently. If you want to have a tattoo or don't want to have one, there's a case to be made any other way today, but it doesn't depend on what the Bible says. So, that would be the first objection I have. Now, the second one most often given is that this would refer instead to cult prostitutes. That there were men who were out there, and they were at the temple, and you were supposed to have intercourse with them, and that would be part of your ritual service. The first thing is, we need to see more evidence that this was the case, because we find a whole lot about shrine prostitutes, not necessarily on the other hand. Prostitutes, by and large, are women serving for men. I'm not saying they don't exist the other way, but we need to have more evidence that, yes, this was a common phenomenon in the biblical times. But the greater objection to this is to look at the text and see what else it's talking about. Does this really just apply to priests? Look at all the sexual prohibitions. I mean, I'm just going to give some examples here. Do not dishonor your father by having sexual relationships with your mother. She is your mother. Do not have relations with her. Does that mean, for instance, that anyone else besides a priest could have slept with their mother? Does anyone even really want to think that? Or don't have relations with your daughter-in-law, or your sister, or an aunt, or anyone else. But even more concerning is, let's see what's going on in the surrounding text here. Okay, verse 22 is, don't lie of a man as one lies of a woman. That's detestable. Okay, what's verse 21 say? Do not give any of your children to be sacrificed to Molech, for you must not profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. And now, before we move on to verse 23, let's consider this. Do you think that God would have been just fine if they'd offered their children up to Baal? Of course not. The idea is, avoid child sacrifice. Molech was probably just the most common deity that was doing this today. Now, a reason for child sacrifice would be that you're giving your most valuable to God, and that was seen as something good, and something that would help bring about blessings such as fertility, a good harvest, etc. But in the Christian message, all life, human life that is from God, and it bears His image, and it's not to be treated that way. Well, what about the death of Jesus? The death of Jesus was someone offering themselves on behalf of the people, which in fact was kind of common in the Israelite culture. We find it going on in the Maccabean works in the Old Testament period, that if someone was dying in the service of God, they would often consider themselves dying as a sacrifice for the people. So Jesus then would not be the exact same thing. Jesus would be someone voluntarily giving himself on behalf of others. A small child does not have that capacity. And if you pay attention to any of the accounts, what happened in these kinds of ceremonies, it's horrific. You'd have this big bull statue, and in between would be this slab where the living child would be placed. And the hands of a statue would be heated up to such an extent that the slab itself would start to burn and the child would start crying out. But no one could hear the child. Why? Because there were so many musical instruments playing and drums going that the screams of a child would be drowned out. Now, this was common in the time until, say, good King Josiah showed up and he destroyed the statues that were used, turned them into ruins. In fact, he destroyed them so much that all the refuge was tossed in a valley. Came to be known as Ben Hinnom. In the New Testament, it got the name Gehenna, which pretty much means hell. In other words, hell, when Jesus spoke about it, is a big garbage dump. To the day of Jesus, it was used as a garbage dump. People would take their garbage there, and what did you have to do to get rid of your garbage? You had to burn it. So they would burn it, and when Jesus saw this, he used it as an illustration of hell, which, by the way, was a concept already known about in the Inner Testament period. Jesus did not make it up. So, when we read this text and we see that God condemns offering children as sacrifice, we have to ask, is that really just to the priest? Was it just that the priest weren't allowed to accept child sacrifices? Yeah, also, if that's the case, I should tell you that maybe you should read the story of Jephthah in the Book of Judges a bit differently. But let's go forward. Do not have sexual relations with an animal and defile yourself with it. A woman must not present herself to an animal to have sexual relations with it. That is a perversion. Now, would it mean then that a man could do that? Not at all. What it meant was, you were not to practice bestiality. It was a perversion of a natural order. Men were to be with women, women were to be with men, and neither one was supposed to be with an animal. So, when we look at this text, we see these, we just have to look at the surrounding context. The verse before and the verse after, and say, okay, do we really think this is just some sort of cultic rite going on? That it's saying, just avoid court prostitutes, or just let this apply to the priest only? Or could it be that this is in fact exactly what most commentators throughout history have thought it was? That it was saying, don't do this behavior. Like, this is one of the places that it would seem the text is speaking to us the clearest, especially when it speaks about other sexual behaviors that ought to be restricted. This whole chapter and the next chapter we're going to look at is all about avoiding perverse sexual behaviors. It's not because God is anti-sex. Not at all. It's because God takes sexual purity seriously, and He doesn't do it to restrict us. He does it for our enjoyment. You know, I'd like to expand on that a little bit more, but I think I'm going to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to hit on that somewhat more before going on to my final look at these verses. I'm Nick Peters. I'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite rock radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Rock radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
That is the Grok Radio app that we're talking about, and I definitely urge you to download it. It doesn't take much space up, and it's something that I use when I'm telling people about the stations. And yeah, here's a place where you can go to, and you can listen to all of your favorite shows. Hopefully, the Deeper Waters podcast is one of them. But when I last left, I'd said that God's not out there to restrict our pleasure. I wanted to hit on this a little bit more now. Sometime in the near future, early next month, I'm going to have a Dr. Frieda Busch come on, and she's going to be talking about the sex and hookup culture that we have going on in our society and what's problematic about it. But still, I'm going to say that God intended for this to take place between man and woman within the confines of marriage. Now, why marriage? Because in marriage, you already have a foundation of love, trust, and lifetime commitment. There's no putting one another to the test. There's nothing that says, if I don't please this other person sexually, will they wake up next to me in the morning or not? Will they break up with me? Will they have nothing to do with me anymore? No, if you've got the marriage, that's supposed to already be guaranteed. And as most would tell you, when you start off, things are going to be rough for a while. See? Because you're learning to get used to another person. And what I tell people is, it is far better to dive into the ocean of one person than to wade into the shallow pools of many. Because ultimately, in the other relationship, you're just using one another. In a marriage relationship, if pregnancy comes about, where you've got the whole idea set in there that you're already together, you can be a mother and a father. Well, actually, if pregnancy sets in, you're already a mother and a father. And as a married couple, that relationship there, it'll just be a lifetime of growing and loving together. And you don't have to compare yourself with anyone else. You don't have to worry if you're better than anyone else. You get that lifetime together, and there's supposed to be no shame whatsoever. Now, that doesn't mean that we all have this going on, that there are any difficulties today, and the reason we have these difficulties today, by and large, is because of our divorce culture and such going on, that we've had that even in the marriage relationship, it can be hard to have trust. Now, what does this mean if you're single? If you're single, it means you avoid sex. Now, some of you might think, well, that's very, very hard. That's difficult. Well, if that's the case, here's your solution. Get married. Christianity presents no other alternatives. You either have lifelong chastity, or you get married. There's no middle ground. There's no way to get the benefits without paying the cost. And keep in mind, also, despite what some people might be telling you, if you're a singer, sex is not a requirement to live. Many people lead happy and fulfilling lives, and they are never sexually active. Many people lead happy and fulfilling lives, and they are. There's no requirement. It's required that some people get married, definitely, so that the species can survive. But it's not required that everyone get married. And if everyone gets married, it's not even required that all of them have children. It's just required that they each show within themselves the relationship that God has set aside to be that one fit for raising of children. That's what we're going to be talking about a bit later on, I hope, in this show. But let's go back to the text, and let's look at what I think is one of the best reasons for treating it the way I treat it. Because some people might say, well, this applies to just the nation of Israel. We're not in Old Testament times anymore, so this no longer applies to us. Okay, now this is a weightier objection. This is one I can understand someone making, because it does make sense on the surface in some ways, because there are many things in the Old Testament that we don't follow that way. Are we just picking and choosing? No. What you have to do is look and realize why each law was chosen. What was the purpose of each of it? How did it fit into that society? When you do that, then, you have a basis for saying why you do this. It's not arbitrary. In fact, people who complain about being arbitrary, you'll find they're just as arbitrary. How many of these people do you know who would support, say, murder? Or theft? Or adultery, okay? Some of them might support adultery. But most of them would say, yeah, murder, theft, those are wrong. Well, guess where that's found? The Ten Commandments. Are you picking and choosing, then? The answer is, yeah, they are. We don't want to be guilty of the exact same thing. So is there anything in the text that shows us that this is not just, say, a law for Israel? Why, yes. Yes, there is. We look, starting at verse 24 in chapter 28, we read, do not defile yourselves in any of these ways, because this is how the nations that I am going to drive you out before you became defiled. Even the land was defiled, so I punished it for its sin. And the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you must keep my decrees and my laws. The native-born and the aliens living among you must not do any of these detestable things. Detestable, again, is the exact same word. But for all these things were done by the people who lived in the land before you, and the land became defiled. If you defile the land, it will vomit you out as it vomited out the nations that were before you. Everyone who does any of these detestable things, same word again, such persons must be cut off from their people. Keep my requirements and do not follow any of the detestable customs that were practiced before you came, and do not defile yourselves with them. I am the Lord your God. Okay, what's going on here? See, the Israelites were about to enter the Promised Land, except the Promised Land was already inhabited. And the people who inhabited it weren't exactly the people you wanted to have as neighbors. And so they had to go and clean up. But why did God not want these people in the land? Why? Because of the wicked practices that they did. What wicked practices? The ones he's just told you about in these verses. See, we often have this idea that, or at least atheists would give us the idea that the Israelites came into the land, and before they came, all these people were nice, happy people living in peace, just good, ordinary, moral people. And here comes these barbarous, warmongering Israelites who tossed them all out. Well, no. That's not the case. First off, these people were often engaging in child sacrifices, in orgies, and other practices that we condemn today. And secondly, the Israelites didn't come in and throw these people out all at once. This was a gradual conquering of a nation that took several years. And in fact, most of these people were nomadic tribes. And so they would be used to picking up and moving out. In fact, they had 40 years worth of warning to know Israel was on its way. And when Israel shows up, who would be the people that are left behind? It's not going to be everyone. It's going to be the men who are the most committed to the pagan practices. The rest of them, they would just get up and move and say, hey, they're coming. We don't want to fight them. We can't take them. Let's go live somewhere else. Notice that Israel was never told to go out and conquer all these other pagan nations around them, even though they were surrounded by them. They were told, however, to keep house in their own land. Now, when God gives these commands to them about the land, what he says is that it's because of these practices that these other nations are being thrown out, which means they should have known better. God's not punishing them for things they wouldn't have known. He's not punishing them because they don't keep the Sabbath. In the book of Nehemiah, you find that God orders the people to lock the gates of Jerusalem on the Sabbath and not do any exchanges. But there's nothing out there that has them going to the merchants who are delivering on the Sabbath and saying, "How dare you pagans go out and sell your goods on this holy day? Why don't you follow the commands of the law?" Pagans are never told they must follow the Sabbath. Israel is told they must follow it. That's part of the covenant they have with God. But the pagans aren't told that. Pagans aren't in that covenant. But the pagans do have a requirement for God that everyone has by virtue of being human, whether you're a Jew or a Gentile. That requirement is, live a holy life before God. Now, what we're talking about then is natural law thinking. And this is the idea that there are moral laws that exist outside of the Bible that can be known apart from special revelation. They're part of what we call general revelation. Just a moment's thinking on this should show you that this is the case even in the Bible. It's not that when the Israelites were traveling through the wilderness, they get to Mount Sinai, and Moses goes up and gets the law and comes down and says, "Hey guys, got some news for you. We have to stop this murdering thing going on." Israelites already knew they weren't supposed to murder. Well, if that's the case, then what is the purpose of the Ten Commandments? The purpose would be that morality and righteousness was to be the definition of the people. It was supposed to be how they were to be recognized. They would be recognized as a holy nation set apart to the Lord. And to show they were set apart, they would keep the covenants. In many ways, the Ten Commandments are just like a marriage proposal. It's God's covenant with the people to enter into a long-term relationship. And we find this language showing up in Hosea 2. It said that God gives his people a certificate of divorce because of how they've lived. And because of that, they will go off and live in a pagan nation. And the whole story in that book with Gomer being compared to the people of Israel at the time, it's one of the most powerful stories that you can find. So, when we look at this text, we can see if these people did not have any idea that these practices were forbidden, on what grounds could they have been judged? There isn't any. But the whole idea is they were supposed to know offhand that, yes, you are not to engage in these kinds of practices. Now, let's look at the next chapter about this, with chapter 20. When we get there, we see verse 18. We see verse 13. If a man lies with a man as one lies with a woman, both of them have done what is detestable. They must be put to death. Their blood will be on their own heads. Now, this is pretty much the exact same scenario going on as in the earlier chapter. But now we've spelled out that, here's the consequences of it. In fact, we find that for many of these other principles. And keep in mind, this is only for Israel. When we get to the New Testament times, for instance, Paul writes 1 Corinthians, and in the 5th chapter, there's a man who's sleeping with his father's wife. Now, Israelite law was very clear on this kind of thing. it would be death. In fact, verse 11 has it. If a man sleeps with his father's wife, he has dishonored his father. Both a man and a woman must be put to death. Their blood will be on their own heads. But in Paul's case, what does he say? He says, expel the brother from among you. Not in the way of death, because we know that the reason for the expulsion is the hopes that the man will come to his senses when he's removed from the community and say, whoa, I want to get back there. I want to be in good standing with the community. I don't want to be cut off from my people. So already, there is a change that's going on there. So when we use this passage, no one should certainly get the idea that Christians are saying, we want to go out and we want to kill homosexuals. That should never be our goal. But if you were part of the nation of Israel and you were agreeing to live in the covenant, you were to abide by the covenant. If you were a foreigner living in there, that would be a different thing. But if you came in and you said, I'm not going to just dwell among you a little bit as a foreigner, your people would be my people, my God would be your God would be my God, then you were to say, and I will observe the rules that your God has laid down. If you don't, then in essence, you're guilty of treason. And that becomes a punishable offense. Now, when we look at this passage, what does it say at the end, in starting at verse 22? Keep all my decrees and laws and follow them, so that the land where I am bringing you to live may not vomit you out. You must not live according to the customs of the nations I'm going to drive out before you. Because they did all these things, I abhorred them. But I said to you, you will possess their land, I will give it to you as an inheritance in a land full of milk and honey. I am the Lord your God who has set you apart from the nations. Now to be fair, yeah, he does go on after that to talk about unclean animals and such. But there's nothing in there that says that the other nations are guilty of this. Instead, what he says is, this is a way you're going to be set apart from the nations to be your own. This was going to be a way you could recognize the people of Israel. It would be not just their lifestyle, but their diet, their customs. Everything about them was to say, we are the people of Yahweh. Every single thing. But when it came to the moral law going on, the culture surrounding them was not to be punished for failing to differ between clean and unclean foods. They were punished because they were doing things that were immoral. Things everyone knows are immoral, or should know are immoral. In fact, we have to realize this with the New Testament times, that when we come to something like, say, the Great White Throne Judgment, see, some people say, well, why isn't God fair with people? But actually, he is. He's incredibly fair. He's not arbitrary at all. It's not that the system of salvation has a point score set up. You get 1,000 points, you're into the kingdom. If you do this good deed, you get this many points. If you do this bad deed, you lose this many points. Most of us would think a system like that's chaos. We live in fear, tabulating our points for the rest of our lives and wondering, did we do good enough? And it would be arbitrary. Who determines how many points each action's worth? Who determines how many points you need? And isn't this ignoring bad deeds the same way I just settle for your best overall? Now, God's standard is perfection. So when it comes to salvation, what he says is, you have to be perfect. Note this. If you're not perfect, and you're not perfect in the sense that you have not recognized Jesus, who takes your place and offers your perfection on his perfection on your behalf, if you don't have Christ, God has only one thing he can judge you by. Your own life, your own sins, and your own good deeds. And those have to be absolutely perfect. If they're not, you get judged for that. What? That's fair. That's consistent. He's requiring the same thing of you and me that he's requiring of everyone else. and exactly what he required of Jesus and exactly what Jesus gave him on our behalf. Well, we're going to go into the New Testament after this. I'm Nick Peters, the host of the Deeper Waters podcast. My number is 714-242-5180 if you want to call and discuss this important topic.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
Okay, I'm Nick Peters, and we are back to the Deeper Waters podcast. I do apologize already. My allergies are doing a number on me today, but the show must go on. Sorry about that. Well, now we're going to get into the New Testament. What we're often told is Jesus never said anything about this issue. But there are a few problems with this. First off, just because Jesus never said anything about an issue, does that mean he didn't consider it important? Jesus never said anything about rape, for instance. Jesus never said anything about incest. He never said anything about pedophilia. Jesus was silent on many topics. Now, if he's silent on any topic, what should we gather from that? Should we gather tacit approval of it? Well, no. Because in fact, when we look at Jesus, we see he, when it came to the moral law of God, upheld it entirely. In fact, he didn't just uphold it, he raised the bar tremendously. So, you're a Jew, you're looking at the Ten Commandments, and you're saying, don't murder. Got bad, going good. And you're going off happy with yourself, whistling a little tune, and then, oh, well, here's a Jewish teacher giving a sermon up here on this mountain. I think I'll go listen to what he has to say. And you hear him say, you have heard it was said, you shall not murder. You hear it saying, yep, okay, this is going to be good. I got that one covered. And then the teacher goes on to say, but I tell you, do not be angry with your brother. Okay, now this is getting problematic because anyone can get angry with their brother a lot of times. Well, maybe that's a misunderstanding. You have heard it was said, do not commit adultery. Okay, happily married guy, don't sleep around with other women. I'm doing good there. But I say to you, don't lust after another man's wife. Every single guy out there has a problem at this point. As I've even heard Dr. Gagnon say that if spiritual adultery was the grounds for divorce, as in just a man looking and lusting after another woman, every single woman out there would have grounds for divorce at that point. Most guys couldn't hardly go a day without struggling with lust in some ways. That's just the kinds of creatures we are. And if we're going to be good husbands, if we're married, then we have to guard ourselves and watch ourselves. Like, I have friends, as a married man, I can go to who are holding me accountable. And I know that if they really thought that I wasn't honoring my wife sexually, that if I was looking at other women and such, they'd come to me and say, Nick, we think you're doing this. Is it true? And if it is, you need to stop, and we're going to help you out. I've told them, that I want you to be able to look me straight in the eye, and if you think I'm not doing something properly in my marriage to honor my wife, you tell me so. And guys, if you're married, I think it would behoove you to do that exact same thing. When I give counsel, I try to avoid counseling women as much as I can. I leave that up to other women, by and large. because I know the way relationships can form. And don't say, well, you're just on the computer. Do you know how many relationships can be ruined because of interactions on the computer? This is something serious. Men, we have to be careful. And of course, women have to be careful also. Women can be just as prone to temptation, though in a different way. But men are creatures who have a tendency to lust. And so when we look at Jesus, Jesus says, avoiding murder isn't enough. You have to avoid anger with your brother. Avoiding adultery isn't enough. You have to avoid lusting after another woman. When the moral bar is presented for Jesus' audience, Jesus doesn't lower the standards for us. He raises them to a level we can never really reach. In fact, this is one reason that some people looked at the Sermon on the Mount and said, yeah, the Sermon on the Mount is an exposition about how ruined we are and how much we need God. It's a way you can understand that for sure. I think it's actually a way you're supposed to recognize people of the kingdom, because people of the kingdom are supposed to be striving to live this way. See, Jesus never went against what the law said on moral grounds. He always upheld it. In fact, he made it stronger. Why should I think that Jesus would have done anything different with the sexual laws that are mentioned in Leviticus 18 and 20? Especially if, as I have shown, those are part of a moral law, which would be unchanging, eternal, and for all people in all times and all places. Why should I think Jesus would treat it differently? Now, you can say that he would have, but you know what? You're going to have to give me an argument. And by the way, if I haven't given the number this hour, it's 714-242-5180, because if you have a complaint with what I'm saying, you can also give me a call and we'll talk about it. So right now, all lines are open. But was Jesus really silent on this issue? Well, not entirely. When we go to Matthew 19, we read this. When Jesus had finished saying these things, he left Galilee and went to the region of Judea to the other side of the Jordan. Large crowds followed him, and he healed them there. Some Pharisees came to him to test him. They asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Haven't you read, he replied, at the beginning, the Creator made them male and female, and said, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. Why then, they asked, did Moses command a man to give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness and marries another woman commits adultery. The disciples said to him, if this is a situation between a husband and a wife, it is better not to marry. Jesus replied, not everyone can accept this word, but only those to whom it has been given. For some are eunuchs because they were born that way. Others were made that way by men. And others have renounced marriage because of the kingdom of heaven. For one who can accept this should accept it. Okay. What's going on here? I need to notice something about this passage. God, the name God, is not mentioned. Jesus hasn't hesitated to talk about God numerous several times. What does he say? The Creator. And notice he doesn't say, the Creator made them man and woman. He says instead, the Creator made them male and female. I say, well, that's the same thing. No, it's not. It's not. Because of the exact same reason Jesus says Creator instead of God. Yes, God is the Creator, but why in all the places does Jesus use that word here instead of other places? why does he not use Creator in other locations? Why does he not go around talking about the kingdom of a Creator? Why? Because this is a practice known today as intertextuality, where you might not necessarily have a scriptural quotation. Well, in this case, you do. You have Genesis 2:24 quoted, but you have a reference to one. May the male and female is just part of a verse. What passage is it? Where it goes all the way back to Genesis 1. And as we know, Genesis 1 is a creation account. And when we're on the sixth day of creation, we have that God creates them. And in verse 27 says, or let's start at verse 26 and it says, then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Now, if you're wanting to know more about the Genesis narrative, I suggest you go back and listen to back in June when we had John Walton be on the show. I think the date was June 22nd for that one. And you'll find we did talk about the image of God a good deal. But when we read this text, God created them male and female. And they were to come together and form a new family. In fact, this is what's said in Genesis 2. And this was even before there was father and mother. I believe this is God setting the standard right here. Now, there were some schools of thought in Judaism at the time that did say divorce could happen for any reason. If the wife burnt the toast in the morning for her husband, he could divorce her. But then there were some that were more strict and said, no, it can only be because of adultery. Jesus sides with that side. But he's even stricter. He doesn't say it's a necessity of a divorce, for instance. He gives it, okay, says, yeah, if it happens, it has to be for this reason. But he doesn't say, because this has happened, it has to end in a divorce. He doesn't. In fact, I think Jesus would, by and large, hope that the marriage can stay together, even after something as horrible as adultery, especially for Christians who are supposed to be people of forgiveness. Adultery should never happen amongst us, but when it does happen, how are we going to respond? Now, that doesn't mean it won't take time to recover trust, to rebuild relationships, things of that sort. But it does mean that you will seek to forgive the other person as you have been forgiven. Now, there was also another group around the time known as the Essenes, and they were pretty strict morally. They were totally against polygamy. They had many of the same standards on divorce that they probably wouldn't have been as severe as Jesus. So keep this in mind. Here you got a group that's really strict on more laws in relation to adultery and marriage, and Jesus one-ups them. Now, what does this have to do with homosexuality? Well, look, the basis for polygamy in this one is polygamy is it has the foundation there still of male and female, at least. Except it adds a whole lot of other females to that. That a man can be married to many, many women. Of course, you could say in some cases a woman could be divorced to many men, but by and large it's polygamy that works that way, with the man having more partners. And Jesus would go against that. How do we know that? It says, they are no longer two, but one. But two will become one flesh. Jesus limits the marriage relationship to two people. But he doesn't change the foundation at all. Polygamy, keep in mind, has the foundation still. man and woman, they change the two-ness aspect of it. Jesus keeps the foundation, and he limits it to two people. Now, if Jesus rejects the group that accepts the foundation, what does that tell you about the group that rejects the foundation itself? And that is a group that says homosexual behavior is to be tolerated. Jesus has no place for sexuality except within marriage. He makes repeated statements about sexual immorality in the Gospels. And so what does he say about marriage, though? Two persons, male, female. If Jesus had wanted to say something favorable about homosexuality, this would be the place to do it. There's nothing there. Instead, we find rather the upholding of what every Jew of that day held. Philo upheld this. Josephus upheld this. We don't know of a Jew who didn't. This is not something the Jews were debating at the time. This was them a closed debate. The Torah has spoken. Let's move on. So if we're going to argue that Jesus said nothing in relation to homosexuality, we have to argue as, first off, why would Jesus not accept what had been implicitly, in fact, I'd say even explicitly, shown to be the case as the teaching of the Torah, the holy book that defined Judaism? Why would he not accept that? The second thing we have to ask, if we're going to go this route, is why do we think in this one case that Jesus would lower the standards? Why would he go against the moral teaching and make things simpler? He has not done that on any other issue whatsoever. When we looked at murder, he did not do that. He made things more difficult. When we looked at adultery, he did not do that. He made things more difficult. What someone is asking us to do in this case, then, is to believe against all the evidence that Jesus was the one exception when he never really said anything whatsoever. And I just don't have enough to do that. I really think Jesus has spoken clearly on this issue. Marriage should be one man and one woman. And this is going to be something very difficult to be accepted, as the disciples themselves say. They say, if this is the case, it's better not to marry, because marriage is supposed to be for life, and that's a really long-term investment, a much longer-term investment than any you have. I got married when I was 29. I was 19. It's going to be a much longer-term investment for her. And our commitment there was, till death do us part. It wasn't just like a job interview where if I really wanted to, I could quit the job any time. It wasn't like going to school where I could say, well, you know, I can drop out if I want to. It isn't even like hosting this program. I love the show that I host, but if I had to stop, I could say, well, I have to stop for now. And I can assure you there are no plans of doing that in the near future. But marriage isn't like that. You can't get married and say, nah, I don't really like this, I'm going to get out. Once you're married, you're in there for life. So you'd best do the best, most of it. And you dare not even say, I can get a divorce. Divorce should not be something like that. That shatters the purpose of marriage in so many ways. It destroys the foundation of trust. Well, I believe that's exactly what Jesus has said about homosexuality, and in fact, about sexuality in many ways. Jesus has raised the bar. If we are going to be good Christians, we must make sure our sexual practices are right in line with what Jesus taught. My call-in number is 714-242-5180. I will be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grok Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
Okay, I'm Nick Peters, and I'm back with the Deeper Waters podcast. Our call number is 714-242-5180. We've got 40 minutes left on the show, and I can remind you, according to what we just played, but yes, donations are needed. Please, send them in. The work that we do here, we don't do it for free. And the reading, the studying, the debating, the time I spend doing this show, time I spend contacting guests, getting them to come on, and no guest is paid to come on this show. All of them give of their time freely. And I'm giving them my time freely. But I ask, please be willing to support us financially. For me, you can go to the Deeper Waters blog. You can find a way to support me financially there by clicking on the link. And in fact, I encourage you also go to our Facebook page, like Deeper Waters, and also click there, and there's something you can get so you can subscribe to our newsletter, and you can hear about what we're doing. You can also make donations to us through Risen Jesus, and you can make donations to us through the Ratio Christi Social and Media and Communications Department. And sometime next month, we'll be having a guest on from Ratio Christi to talk about some events that they have going on there. And speaking of guests that we're going to have on, be sure to tune in next week. This is going to be a big one. Okay, next week, Craig Keener will be our guest on the Deeper Waters podcast. You don't know that name? Craig Keener wrote the massive 2-volume book called Miracles, where he documents miracles still going on today. Many of these with medical testimony behind them. Professionals who can say, yes, this person had such and such condition, yes, they were healed. We are going to be talking about those miracle claims. We'll be talking about the objections of David Hume against miracles, why they don't uphold, and we'll definitely be taking your calls if you're skeptical of miracles and want some convincing. But Craig Keener, world-renowned New Testament scholar, one of the best, I'm super hyped to have him as my guest next week. I really hope you're going to be here from 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Now, usually, the clearest passage seen in the Bible about homosexuality is in Romans 1. And starting there, we'll start at verse 18, okay? The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God, nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal men and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator who is forever praised. Amen. Because of this, God gave them over to shame for lust. Even their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves a due penalty for their perversion. Now this is, if there's any passage in the Bible, in the New Testament, that's clear on God's view on homosexual behavior, this is it. And I say at the start, there is no debating that Paul wrote Romans. This is universally accepted to be a Pauline book. I know of no concerns with textual variance in this passage. The text is not really in dispute here. What is in dispute is, what does the text mean? Now, let's go back at the start and see. This is a creation narrative account. It's going to the creation. How do we know this? Remember when we talked about Jesus and how he referenced Creator? Paul does the exact same thing here. They exchange the truth of God for a lie and worship and serve created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen. Their Creator. And we see that, that's intertextuality going on. There's male and female talked about in this passage. And what it is saying this is a natural regression of what goes on. That the society can start with knowing some idea of what the truth is. And it's not saying they know the full gospel, they know Christianity or anything like this. What's known to them is there is a God and he requires that they behave a certain way. How do they know this? Not because they have innate knowledge, but it's because it's been clearly seen from what has been made. So men and women are without excuse. There's no justification. This is how Paul can say the wrath of God is justly being dealt out. It's being dealt out because men and women know better, or they should, at least. If they did not know better, what basis could there be for the wrath of God being revealed? But the wrath of God is revealed because they know better, and they suppress what they know. Now, keep in mind, I think you can suppress it so much that you eventually convince yourself it's not true. You come to actually believe it yourself. So, what does he talk about at the start? Idolatry. See, for the Jew, idolatry was the big sin. This was the one that really ticked God off. When Moses is on Mount Sinai for too long, all the people get impatient, go to Aaron and say, we don't know what's happened to him. We need a God. And what happens? The golden calf. And this became a story that the rabbis hated to look back on later on. It was one of their most shameful accounts ever. They had just received the law, and while we were there, in the presence of God, right at the foot of his holy mountain, they made an idol. And with that idol came sexually immoral behavior. The two were connected every single time. When the people of Midian wanted to lead Israel astray, how did they do it? Sexual temptation, which led to idolatry. The Canaanites would not have led Israel astray had it not been for sexual temptation. And let's face it, it looks pretty good on the outside. You know, how many people wouldn't say, oh yeah, come to our church, you get the best sex you've ever had. And that was part of their worship service. Is it any wonder this was somewhat appealing to the Israelites? But when they got judged for idolatry, it meant you go into exile, you serve in a foreign land for 70 years, you go without my presence, without my temple, and you face the mockery and shame of those around you. When they got back, they started putting their act together. there was not a problem with idolatry, then they became very, very strict in how they followed the law. They were dotting every I and crossing every T. Idolatry then was something to be avoided. Because when you start being an idolater, you start having a low view of God. Sorry. God is reducible to something in nature. You are indeed worshiping the creation instead of the creator. When you do something like this, man, you're going to follow the pathway of nature. In fact, this is something that we see going on today. I've seen, for instance, the meme going around that says that, say, there's 450 animals in which homosexual behavior is found. Homophobia is found in only one. Which one seems unnatural now? That sounds persuasive to some people, but there are so many problems. That one thing, who says we're supposed to take our moral cues from the animals? Now, there are some things we can learn by watching animals. Yes, Proverbs says that, but animals are not to be the ones that we base our whole lifestyle on. We find out some principles. We are never told, follow the sexual practices of animals. And there are some animals that are monogamous, but not many are. In fact, as some have pointed out, in fact, I was one of them, a lot of animals eat their own young. There's only one group that ultimately betrays this and says this is wrong behavior. One group says anything's wrong behavior. That's humans. By this standard, then, we should have no problem, if we accepted this argument, with people wanting to eat their own children. But every one of us would. And something else I've said in response to this meme is that being able to think rationally, as far as we know, is found in only one species, humanity. In the animal kingdom, animals don't think rationally. They think purely on instincts. By this standard, then, thinking is not natural. Therefore, it shouldn't be done. Does anyone want to follow this route? See, there are so many problems when we look to the animal kingdom to be our moral exemplars. Now, I'm not against the animal kingdom. I love the animal kingdom. I think it's great. We're pet owners here. We've got a cat that goes around this house, which he thinks he owns, of course. Sleeps in our bed with us at night, or whatever. We sleep in his bed at night. We love animals. We don't have a problem with animals. Animals are not our gods, though. We don't take our moral cues from the animals. But if you have idolatry, you ultimately reduce God to the level of a creation in some way. And with that will come sexual practices that are lower than what God intended, where sex will become more an animal drive than anything else. And he starts talking about men for some of this passage, and I'm not sure how many of you out there have noticed this, but we men tend to have a high sex drive. That might seem like a shock to some of you, and if it is, where have you been on this planet the whole time? But men have a much higher drive, and when it's men with men, yeah, there's no limit to what's going to go on. It's why, for instance, the AIDS virus spread primarily amongst men at the start, which, by the way, when it first came out, that virus was called GRID, which meant gay-related immunodeficiency. I suspect the name change had to do with political correctness, but it did spread amongst the homosexual community first. That's why there were groups out there such as the Gay Men's Health Crisis. And if you want some documentation of this, the best books you can read on this by Randy Stiltz called And the Band Played On. And some of you listeners out there who might be skeptical of anything, obviously by a homophobe and bigot. No, he was himself a practicing homosexual who also died of AIDS. If you have men with men, there's not much containing it. That's something that marriage does do for men. Marriage gives us an outlet for that sex drive, but it also contains it. Because if you're a good, honorable husband, you're not going to rape your wife or anything like that. You're going to go on her terms and when she's ready. And if that means you have to go out there and prove yourself and perform regularly and such, well, that's what it means. And in fact, usually that is what it means, because women are very slow to respond. That way they need to be shown a whole lot of love such first. Men, we can be turned on and ready to go immediately. Not that way as a woman. Nothing against women, of course, but they're just not wired that way. And I think this is a good thing for us men, because it pushes us men to do even more, to try even harder, to be more loving, more devotional, so much so that eventually the actions sink in and become a lifestyle. So you have to remember, when marriage was in the past, it wasn't that you fell in love and then you asked someone to marry you. Your marriage was usually arranged. The husband and wife would often not even see each other until the wedding night. So what's supposed to build this unity of love between them? It's the bedroom. Because this would make the man want to be with the woman more and more, and to honor her, and the more he does that, he comes to love her over time. For the woman, this gives her some power in relationship. She's not just an object. She is something that the man is to respect. Unless, of course, he wanted to have the community looking down on him. He is to honor her in that way, and when he does, he gets to enjoy the benefits of being married. Now, of course, things didn't always work out the way they were supposed to, the way they were designed to. In fact, when we look at the case against divorce, as we did earlier, that's one of the reasons divorce is so harmful. It does destroy that trust. When you do have a marriage, though, that is against the idea of divorce entirely, then you have that foundation for, as my friends at the Roof Institute like to say, and I hope sometime I can have some of them on here, you get lifelong married love. And in fact, as I just thought about, we do have some of them coming on. Frieda Bush is someone I found out about through the Roof Institute, and Dr. Gagnon himself found out the same way, and he's done a lot of speaking for the Roof Institute, including some debates with Dr. J. And, oh, well, it looks like we have a caller calling in here, so I'm going to take this call right quick. Huh? Caller, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah. What would you have to say about the fact that for the most part, ex-gay ministries have failed, and even leaders and proponents of conversion therapy have retracted?
Yeah, this is a good question. Right now, we are coming up on a break. Would you care if I took the break a little bit early and then came back so we could spend more time answering that question?
No problem.
Okay. We'll be back to discuss ex-gay ministries right here on the Deeper Waters podcast.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok? Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grok as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told. Every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
Okay, we're back on the air, and we do have a caller calling in right now. The number is 714-242-5180. And asking, what do I think about the fact that so many ex-gay ministries have failed. But the main one we've heard a lot... What?
Oh, no. Go ahead.
The main one we've heard a lot about has been Exodus International. And Exodus has been more of a parachute organization that envelops several other smaller organizations. And not all these organizations have gone against this. I'd even say that you can look at last week's Unbelievable program, Justin Browley hosted, and he was a guest on here one time, and where he talked about, had three guests on the show, one of them even describing himself as post-gay, and who was married and with children, says, yes, there's still a struggle here, but I'm able to enjoy my life in a heterosexual lifestyle, be married to my wife, and have children. Now, what we can have a problem with is having this idea that if you're fully treated, it means there will never be any temptation again. And that's really not the case. Especially when it comes to even to like alcoholism. Alcoholics, by and large, will still have a temptation to drink. They just know how to contain it. And also, because ministries have failed at some things, it doesn't mean the whole idea of it is a failure. It means that there is still work to be done. This is still an area worth study. But the fact that there are some people out there who are defining themselves as ex-gay, although the person on the show preferred post-gay, should tell us that this can be changed to an extent.
Yeah, but for example, mainstream science tells that sexual orientation can be changed. The APA, the World Health Organization, all those say that that's not possible. In fact, the only people who are claiming that change is possible are religious organizations.
Was this before the 1970s or after the 1970s?
Well, recent times.
But, so after
the
1970s?
Back then wasn't very... You know, science wasn't very... good back then. There were a lot of theories that were proven to be false, but now we know more.
Okay. What new data came in the 1970s that changed the view on homosexuality? Because it used to be listed in the disorders handbook that they have, but after the 1970s, it got taken out. What new data came in that changed that?
Well, they studied many things, and they found out that it's not really a mental disorder, so that's why they take it out.
Can you cite what paper established that?
Well, it was more like there are several therapists who reviewed the articles, and they say that, well, that's not really a mental disease, so they take it out, and of course, there were people who disagreed, but these were mostly religious or therapists, and that's why they founded like several different organizations like Exodus and so on.
Again, I was still hoping that we get the new kind of data that was discovered, and there's just several papers that nothing specific was given. Could it have more in fact to do with the fact that the homosexual lobby was pushing on the APA to have its stance changed, and there wasn't even really a fair hearing given? So at that time on, there hasn't really been any objective study looking at the topic of changing homosexuality in someone.
Well, you know John Park, who used to be like the poster boy for that kind of movement, and now recently has announced that he never really changed and now divorced his wife, so that kind of puts into question the whole idea, don't you think?
Why? That's kind of what we call a hasty generalization, where you have one sample study, and then because that one case goes wrong, that says something about everyone. It doesn't. It just says there was a problem with John, if that's the case. It doesn't say anything about the possibilities itself, because there are several people out there who will be willing to say, yeah, I was like this, and I was changed.
Well, how can we know that? We don't have any
testimony.
Objective studies on them. They want subjects to test on anything that proves that they're no longer attractive. their own sex. So how can we know? Just by their words.
How else can we know anyway? The only way we can know what someone really thinks and believes is by what they say. And if they say, I was this way, and we see their lifestyle today is something different, then upon what grounds should we reject it?
Well, there's also like objective studies like pineal plethysmographs and computers and measure arousal. Those are pretty objective.
If someone says they were a certain way, and it can be shown they were, and they are living a life today that's no longer that way, why should I reject it?
Well, exactly, but the most people won't subject to that because they know inside that they are still attracted to their own sex, and those methods will disprove that. And even most people who call themselves ex-gay or post-gay will admit that they're still attracted to the same sex. Even Nexus admitted that and caused quite a backlash.
All these people, how do you know that they know inside that they're still attracted to the same sex? How do you know that?
Most people say so.
So they, you know by their testimony. You know by their testimony.
They admit that they're still attracted, that they're still struggle. And that's, that's kind of the point. That's, complete change is possible.
That's exactly what I said, in fact. But notice something. When I said that, when they say that they've changed, their lives are different, they're enjoying married life, and I say, how can we know? And then when I ask you the same question, you know, say, well, we know by their own words. I'm telling you the exact same thing. We know this by their own words. And yes, I said at the start, yes, they do still struggle, just like the alcoholic still struggles. But he's managed to control his desire instead of his desire controlling him.
Well, they say, so if you believe in eternal security, what does it make of people who recant or go back to their previous lifestyle, even if they say they're Christians? Aren't they still safe?
I didn't say I believe in eternal security.
Well, but most people say that even you believe in Jesus, you'll still be saved no matter what you do. So
then find one of them who does hold that position and see what they say. I don't.
Okay. So if you think those people who were so-called ex-gay go back in gay, so they're no longer Christians or saved?
Right. I think if you go and you take a lifestyle that is totally contrary to a Christian faith and yet still profess Christ, then you are deceiving yourself.
Okay, let me tell you one more thing. You say that now the New Testament forbids pedophilia, right?
Yeah.
So let me tell you this. You know how old Mary was when she got pregnant with Jesus?
Yep.
How old was she?
She would probably be 12, 13, or 14.
And do you think that's something that should be allowed today?
Today? No. Back then, I have no problem with it because in that society, child marriage happened at a much lower age because people didn't live as long. You need to get married earlier. You need to go and establish your own family. This is part of judging the culture by its own standards. There is nothing magical about the age 18 today that suddenly makes someone capable of having a full sexual marriage relationship. Nothing magical in the number whatsoever.
And why should that be magical in the gender? Why should that still be relevant today?
To the gender?
Yeah.
Because male and female are the ones that are capable of creating a new family together on their own through the process of procreation.
You know that the same is possible for incest and for polygamy, right? All those things generate life.
Mm-hmm.
So you are okay that should be allowed?
No. I've also given my other reasons. I've given my reasons elsewhere for saying, in fact on the show, for saying why I'm against polygamy and incest, because both of them break down the marriage unit, and with incest, it destroys the family unit that's already there.
Okay, well, that's all I needed to hear from you. Thank
you. Mm-hmm. Well, I really hope this is kind of being an example of what's going on. Man, people, this is all about the family unit. Now, when we look at what Paul has said here in Romans 1, somebody asked some questions. Well, if Paul had known about loving, committed, same-sex relationships, he might have said something differently, which implies that Paul didn't know anything about that. He did. If you want to know about this, pick up a copy of Plato. Read the Symposium, where an account's given of how humanity once was, that they were these monstrosities that walked around with four legs and four arms and such, and Zeus got scared about them. So what happens, here comes the lightning bolts, and they split these creatures in two. And now, each half is looking for the half that he corresponds to. Some men are looking for men, some women are looking for women, and some men are looking for women, and some women are looking for men. But Paul was very well familiar with that account of men looking for men and women looking for women. See, the ancient culture had many different things to say about homosexuality. Some did condemn it. Plato later did condemn it in the laws. Some upheld it. There wasn't no one voice speaking in the pagan empire. But everyone knew about loving and committed relationships between people of the same sex. Like, no one's denying that people of the same sex can have loving and committed relationships. In fact, they should. It's called friendship. It's something we should all have. I'd say my relationships with my male friends, the closest ones, are loving and committed relationships. We are each seeking the good of one another, and we're friends through it all, through thick and thin. And these were the guys I had that were the groomsmen and the best man at my wedding. I chose them because I saw them as good friends I could count on no matter what. That's the way it's meant to be. But the problem comes when we sexualize these relationships and make them something they weren't meant to be. Now, would Paul have known also about so-called sexual orientation? Yeah, he would have known about people having that drive just to be with someone of the same sex. And by the way, as has been brought out in the blog, Gays Defend Marriage, but I think David Burkhoff is his name. I could have that wrong, but my apologies if I do. But he's a homosexual Jew who writes a blog, Gays Defend Marriage, or he did write it for a while. There are still some good stuff on there, and talk about interviewing several professors and said sexual orientation, so-called today, is really a modern category. Now, a case I've been brought up asking here by the callers just now, is it something immutable? Well, let's consider this. Just because something could not be changed does not mean it is ipso facto moral. I have a sinful nature about me. I desire many things that I should not desire. I find these desires very hard to change. Does that mean, therefore, that these desires are moral? Not for a second. I seriously doubt Allie would be fine with me having a sexual relationship with another woman if I just said, "Honey, I'm sorry, but I just have this great desire for sex in me, and I want as much as I can. And if I went with another woman also, you're just going to have to understand that." She wouldn't understand it. I can assure you, my parents wouldn't understand it. My in-laws wouldn't understand it. And my friends wouldn't understand it. No one would. They would say, "No, you have to get your desires in check and realize which desires are good and which are bad." Just because you have a desire does not mean it is good. And as we said, alcoholism, which, by the way, alcoholism can be incredibly difficult to treat, nearly impossible in some cases, but it can be done. And as we've said, it doesn't mean the person no longer has a desire to drink. there's probably still a strong desire every time that person drives by a bar. But the point is, the desire is no longer the controlling factor in their life. And unfortunately, we find in homosexual relationships a lot of time the desire is the controlling factor in life. Like I say, in your own marriage, if all that's controlling you is sexual desire and not love for your spouse, that's a problem. Sexual desire, I think, is a start. It's meant to be that way, but it's not meant to stay that way. And something else we can say about this Pauline passage, this is the one passage, in fact, that speaks about lesbianism directly. And it speaks about it in the exact same terms that speaks about homosexual relationships between men. It is my understanding that the pagan philosophers, they might have been somewhat iffy with men on men. They weren't with women on women. That was condemned. If Paul condemns them in the same breath that he condemns men on men relationships, we need to realize this is Paul's stance then. Now, we've only got about 4 minutes left, so I can tell you there is so much more that could be said. And when we have Dr. Gagnon on later on, hopefully again in October, and I invite my call back in then and ask him about some of these, because I can tell you Dr. Gagnon knows a whole lot more about this than I do. And when we have him come on, we'll hear even more about this. And I really urge you, if you're interested in that show, go out and get the book beforehand, The Bible and Homosexual Practice, and learn it where. You'll find it will be an exceptionally helpful read for you. But what we find is that when this passage, if we're going to take it seriously, we have to say, yes, Paul does condemn this. Now, for the sake of argument, we could all look and say, maybe the Bible is wrong in what it says. Okay, I'm willing to grant that for the sake of argument. And it doesn't affect me in the public square, because in the public square, I don't use the Bible. I use just reason. And so, when we're looking at this topic, I can look and say, well, we got someone calling in again, so let's see. Okay, you got about 2.5 minutes.
Okay, I just want to add one more thing. You aware that studies have shown that there's no difference among children who are raised by same-sex parents and among those who are raised by heterosexual parents? Call that a break of the family unit.
And are you aware about Wegener's study that has shown otherwise?
Yes.
And has found that there was no malpractice done in his study, and it's the most thorough study today?
Actually, that has been disproven. Even the people who edited his journal had admitted that it was wrong, that he didn't study children by same-sex parents. He studied children who were in his heterosexual family unit and whose one of their parents split and joined a homosexual union. So wouldn't that be like a...
Exactly? Actually, no, that's not the case, because there was a study done by the university, look at it, and found that there was no wrongdoing on his part. Yes, he wishes he had phrased the relationship status better, but he said he had to do what he had to ask, would you define as a homosexual relationship and such. You can hear about this at the Roof Institute. But right
none
now...
None of the children that he studied, or very little in any, were raised by same-sex parents. They were originally from heterosexual parents whose one of their parents joined a homosexual union. So if anything, that would be an argument to not let homosexuals marry heterosexuals, but in fact marry people of their own sex, don't you think?
Look, we've got a minute left, so we'll have to end it with this, but say, no, that has not been the case. That's what has been commonly asserted. If anyone wants to listen to this, go to the Roof Institute. You can hear Regnerus himself talking about this. And if you have a problem with it, you can feel free to email him. But I'm going to have to let you go at that point. Sorry, but we've got 40 seconds left. If you want to, you can call in when Gagnon's on here again. But for now, I have to sign us off, okay? And We'll be here next week. Our guest will be Craig Keener. The call-in number then will be 714-242-5180. And I'm Nick Peters right now, signing off. We'll see you next week.